This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Thank you, Engelbert. I shall try very hard to keep to my 20-minute slot. In 1978, in the very first edition of the Journal of Post-Keynesian Economics, Joan Robinson wrote, Sraffa, 1960, was not published until 1960. Sraffa had shown a draft to Keynes in 1928. Keynes evidently did not make much of it, and Sraffa, in turn, never made much of the general theory. It is the task of post-Keynesians to reconcile the two. This challenge was taken seriously for at least a decade, in particular through the Trieste Summer School, which ran from 1981 to 1990, but ended in apparent failure as far as that objective was concerned. Several post-Keynesian authors, notably Sheila Dow and Stephen Dunn, have argued that the two approaches are incompatible. By contrast, Gary Mongeauvi and Marc Lavoie have argued that it is dangerous for post-Keynesian economics to adopt a small tent view, a la Davidson, while Paul Davidson himself has argued forcibly, and to my mind convincingly, that a view should not be called post-Keynesian if it is incompatible with Keynes. I'm about to poke a stick into this currently dormant hornet's nest by coming out in favour of Joan Robinson's view. I build my bridge from the so-called fundamental Keynesian side of the rift, where I have spent most of my scholarly time, and I have still much to read about what used to be called in my undergraduate days neo-Ricardian theory, and is now the surplus approach to value and distribution. This is very much a first poke at the nest, which I contribute to this workshop as a basis for discussion rather than a finished product in the spirit which I think Engelbert wishes to encourage. And here I'm following Keynes rather than Sraffa's approach to the airing of half-formed, I hope not half-baked, ideas. So, why bother? First of all, what is the nature of the Great Divide? In a nutshell, it corresponds to the difficulty of reconciling equilibrium with uncertainty. The methodological turn in post-Keynesian economics, from which I have greatly benefited, has emphasised the open and fluid character of the social material which we study, and the inappropriateness, accordingly, of much mathematical theorising. And this perspective is of great value for understanding the concept of fundamental uncertainty, which no post-Keynesian can dispense with, I propose. Nevertheless, when fundamental uncertainty develops into radical indeterminacy, I think we've gone too far. I've recently published a paper on Keynes's state of short-term expectation, in which I take apart Jan Kregel's seminal 1976 paper on expectation and equilibrium, and I'm waiting for the thunderbolt to strike me down. The paper also involves criticism of Vicky Chick's position, at least to the extent that it's based on Kregel, and she's been most gracious in debating the point with me at the Keynes seminar, which you can listen to, dated 9th of March 2010. In one sense, that paper is focused on a rather fine point of Keynesiology, as Michael Ambrosi would say. Whether Keynes assumes, in his exposition of the principle of effective demand, that short-term expectations are fulfilled. And the relevance of the paper to the present subject is that I argue that Keynes treats short-term and long-term expectations quite differently. I suggest that Keynes adopts an assumption of what he called judicious foresight, and we would now call rational expectations, in his analysis of the short term. The long term, of course, is quite a different matter. Thus, for me, the principle of effective demand is a theory of the formation of short-term expectations, meaning the prices expected for current production, prices of production, as a set of instantaneous equilibrium prices determined by supply and demand. And my key to this approach is the introduction of a division of entrepreneurs into the categories of employers and dealers, a division of function which is entirely observable in the real world. And while I'll never be able to prove beyond doubt that Keynes adopted this approach in the general theory, I have cited considerable evidence in my paper from his discussion with Hawtrey that this division was part of the common sense substrate of Cambridge thinking at the time. Accordingly, when I say that short-term expectations are determined by supply and demand, I mean supply by employers of labour and demand by dealers of goods, dealers in goods. Demand by dealers, not final demand by consumers, nor usually demand by ultimate investors. The problem here is time. In this context, production time. Services are a bit different, but goods and equipment cannot be created instantly on demand. And production periods from field or mine to retail shelf can be a year or more in length. So most goods are purchased from dealers, specialised investors who forecast onward demand for particular goods over a longer or shorter interval of time. And here is the chink through which I see the way to make a link to Sraffa. Yet before we look through the chink, why do we need to? I would be the first to accept that the general theory is a work of genius, not only in its vision, but in its theoretical precision, which has been seriously underestimated by friend and foe alike. I've also argued in my 2006 book that in creating a Marshallian macroeconomics, a theory of the equilibrium of industry as a whole, Keynes addressed and overcame Sraffa's 1926 criticism of the Marshallian theory of value at the theoretical level of logical consistency. It's utterly false to claim, as some do, that the general theory is incoherent and devoid of appropriate micro-foundations. Yet, the general theory has its limits. I'm saying that. In particular, Keynes admitted in his exchange with Dunlop, Tarsius and Kaletsky about cyclical movements in the real wage that the empirical evidence calls into question the foundations of the Marshallian theory of value. And a considerable strand of modern post-Keynesian thinking, notably by Fred Lee and Paul Downward, building on earlier work by Ken Coutts, Wynne Godley, others, recognises that firms do not usually take auction prices or set them equal to marginal cost. Now, Keynes aspired towards an economic science in which theory can be confronted with evidence. He was therefore seriously concerned by the findings of Dunlop, Tarsius and Kaletsky. The problem with the general theory is not that it contains no theory of value, but that it contains a theory of value which does not correspond to the facts. This is a criticism, not only of Keynes, but of the entire edifice of marginalist economics within which he chose to cast the general theory. Now, the task of replacing marginalist theory was, of course, the life ambition of Piero Sraffa. Although he shares the fate of Keynes in being widely misunderstood, his endeavour was to contribute to the production of a scientific theory of value which avoids the descent into metaphysics represented by Marshall's attempt to build a science based on the measurement of motives. there's some irony in the fact that in the hands of his successors, at least in the view of their critics, Strafford's system has become associated with an ideal, timeless, equilibrium position without empirical counterpart, or indeed any room for post-Keynesian concerns about expectations, long or short term. And it was when I heard Mansoop Park give a paper at the Keynes seminar this year. You can listen to him and Fabio Petri talking about it online, that I grasped the possibility of a synthesis between Strafford and Keynes through our shared recognition that long period does not mean long term, and that the use of the term long run merely confuses matters. Long period refers to logical time and long term to historical time. Jeff Harcourt argues for following Joan Robinson in understanding long period as an adjective rather than a substantive. Garignani insisted that the long period or normal rate of profit is located in the present. In the general theory, the long period position means the equilibrium employment that arises when the capital stock has fully adjusted to a given state of expectation, so that in Strathian or Kaletskian terms, the capital equipment is being utilised at its normal level. Mansoop suggests, and I quote him here, the Strafford system of production prices refers, his emphasis, to a fully adjusted position under the condition of free competition. Just referring, that is, even if prices determined in the Strafford system are established and the economy is in free competition, there is no need for the economy to be actually in a fully adjusted position. Fine, but then the same question arises as in the Marshallian system. Where do Strafford's prices of production reside if they are not observable as market prices? Are they any less metaphysical than Marshall's normal prices? And I suggest Keynes's answer to this is clear. They exist in the minds of entrepreneurs. This does not make them metaphysical. The decisions about production and employment that are made by firms on the strength of their expectations are perfectly concrete and observable. Expectation determines output and employment, the title of chapter 5. The question for theory remains, what determines the expectations? And how can these be objective in the sense of the unique shared state of expectation to which Keynes constantly refers? And this is the problem I've addressed in my previous work. In my rationalisation of the general theory, these expectations are forward market prices struck each day between the employers and the dealers. The dealers have expectations in the wider non-technical sense of forecasts of the likely level of future demand for their goods from consumers or investors, including other firms. But unlike in marginalist theory, consumer demand is a function not only of relative prices and preferences, but also of less than full employment income, fashion, and the whole host of influences Keynes calls the subjective influences on consumption. And this allows for the full development of post-Keynesian consumer theory as proposed by Lavoisier, and indeed a valuable connection between theoretical economics and the practical study of marketing. And on the investment side, well, as we all know, investment demand cannot be reduced to rational expectations. So, however manifold and complex the influences upon the formation of dealers' forecasts, I'm going to call them forecasts, may be, the dealers must place orders with employers in order to obtain the goods they need for stock. In the general theory, the supply conditions are Marshallian, with firms taking prices under perfect competition and offering quantities in line with marginal cost. The forward prices are the expectations, the expected prices, which constitute the state of short-term expectation and correspond to a unique level and composition of effective demand. And as Keynes notes, even if there are no formal forward markets, one can expect this set of prices to be discovered by trial and error, given the state of long-term expectation and the propensity to consume. This framework can equally well accommodate the Sraffa price equations under conditions of free rather than perfect competition. And in the paper, I've got a mathematical appendix, which I'm not going to bother you with. Furthermore, it's empirically reasonable and in line with post-Keynesian pricing theory to assume that employers set prices as a markup on normal costs, that is, their expectation of average or long period cost rather than marginal cost, while dealers set purchase quantities in line with their forecasts of final demand. Generally, dealers in turn set their own selling prices and take the resulting quantities from final customers. But note the critical point that these final sales quantities are known only at a future date. Thus, in dealers' orders, we have the exogenous quantities of output that drive the rest of Sraffa's system. That's the key. Given the technical conditions of production and the uniform rate of profit on capital, towards which the various markups tend under free competition, the equilibrium prices are determined. These prices are expectations, in the same sense as before, a constellation of forward prices for delivery of goods to dealers at a variety of different dates corresponding to different periods of production, not just one harvest cycle. There's no reason why dealers' orders should not change from day to day, long before the previous day's orders have been delivered. And as orders change, so will the equilibrium prices, unless there are constant returns to scale, which is often the case, but is not necessarily the case. Keynes's core insights are maintained, but based on the classical rather than the neoclassical theory of value and distribution. Where does this leave long-term expectation and investment or accumulation? I find it interesting that Sraffa himself does not address accumulation. He makes no assumption about the division of the net product between consumption and investment. It is therefore possible to adopt his approach to the theory of value and distribution without necessarily foregoing an approach to investment and economic growth which recognises money and uncertainty. We can substitute Sraffa's theory of value for Marshall's within the framework of the general theory without doing violence to either Sraffa or Keynes. The key to this is the recognition of the state of short-term expectation as a set of equilibrium prices that may shift from day to day, but are nevertheless objective and reflect what we call the long period fully adjusted position. These prices of production may even be observable in the form of forward market or catalogue prices. So reconnecting equilibrium with reality and Sraffa with Keynes, it seems to me, are big steps forward. And there I end.